So it's a pleasure to be here today. My name is Eric Weinstein, and I suppose that at some point I casually said to Lee, you know, what we really need is an economic Manhattan Project. And then suddenly the wheels were in motion, and things started happening. So I guess welcome to the Economic Manhattan Project. And this talk is called A Science Less Dismal, because while there's a lot of apologizing for economics, I think we have potentially the opportunity to do something really amazing, perhaps transcendent. And I think that there are reasons we are at the Perimeter Institute that haven't been mentioned. One is the Willie Sutton reason. If Willie Sutton robbed banks because that's where the money is, then a lot of the expertise that we may need to solve problems is in a place like a physics department. And I will point out that physicists have been, and I say this as somebody not trained specifically as a physicist, spectacularly successful crossing boundaries. We in mathematics got invaded on the strength of something called the BPST instanton in the mid-70s, which ushered in an era, a renaissance between mathematics and physics, very much akin to the renaissance in biology in the 50s, where many of the most famous biologists are actually physicists by training. I disagree with Lee that physicists can be arrogant, insufferable, but they're very, very good, and they do tend to play by the rules. They have a great rigorous culture, and those of us who have been invaded, in general, are the better for it. So it's been a terrific experience for us in mathematics, and what I'm hoping is that physics has a chance to catalyze something really remarkable here, and I hope you'll hold me to it. This is, in fact, a tale of two crises, in my opinion. A financial crisis, but also an intellectual crisis as its parent. And the intellectual crisis is going to keep on going, if I'm correct, long after the financial crisis is wrapped up. And that may affect the drugs in your medicine cabinet. It may affect the climate and the world in which you live. There are all sorts of ways in which we have developed this kind of magical thinking about self-regulation of systems, which may not, in fact, work as advertised. So while we're in the middle of a financial crisis, that crisis is, in general, under the stewardship of a relatively small group of people. And those people require constant access to very proprietary information. We don't have that information. And we cannot set ourselves up to fail because we are not in a position to solve that crisis. So we are going to have to think about that from a different perspective. But there's a second small group of people. And those people I got a chance to know, not really around the time that this crisis is frequently called for, but in the period from about 2001 to 2005, when I basically gave up, a small group of quantitatively minded people, Nassim prominent among them, Adil also here with us, Bill Janeway, people who spoke out, who said we are going to cause ourselves a tremendous problem, and we're in a very, I don't know how to say it. One of the things that doesn't get said, if you didn't speak out during this period of time, you don't know the incredible social pressure that could be brought to bear for making dark clouds when everybody else saw rainbows, sunshine, and lollipops. And so in that setting, the people who were talking about, let me give you a metaphor. Very often it's claimed that information that is publicly available is instantly digested. If you go to the train station in New York for the train headed for Boston, you'll find that there's a giant board that says departures. And people wait there for their train to Boston, and they run to get a good seat. But there's a tiny screen that says arrivals. And the same train is listed on the tiny screen. And so whenever you go for the train for Boston, if you go by using the arrivals screen, you always find a tiny group of people on the platform who figured out the trick and get there early and get the good seats. In many ways, some of the people in this audience, Adil, Nassim, Bill, strike me as the people who were waiting in that small group for that train when everybody else was watching the departure board. I should say Nouriel more than anyone, but I have yet to meet Nouriel. This conference, what? This conference is about the argument between these two groups as seen from a specifically scientific perspective. Now, I tried to go back in time and think what it was like to be thinking these seditious thoughts that the world was going to come undone, that we were creating analytics that were specifically gameable, that those gameable analytics were going to be held up as rigorous because they were data-driven. And there was a mania for data during this period. And theory was absolutely at a low point. And so there was a strong preference for people who could say things through metrics. And what I was claiming was that the metrics were constructed exactly to have a giant blind spot. As you can see, the fellow on the left was extremely optimistic about the resiliency of the system. And while he saw risks that had increased, they were outweighed by the new safety mechanisms and the increased potential for the system to form a resilient safety net that was under some process of self-control. In general, this is the tale of two groups of people and how they fare. And the question that arises is, what happens to those who speak out and have some measure of either predictive power or descriptive power who are born out compared to this other group, and why are their fortunes different? So the question I'm asking is, why would the world government systematically avoid a group which warned of disaster? In general, if I look at the people in power, I find that the people who warned of disaster are ill represented within that group. What if there was actually a reason that we were going to select adversely against people who had some degree of predictive power because they had some kind of a loyalty to a highly rigorous system that did not allow for highly plastic conclusions? And then when the theory or the data started to go in a direction that was not kind to a predetermined conclusion, those people became too inconvenient to maintain within a system that was trying to reach particular conclusions. So we started to get some evidence that this is in fact the case, right? People who had been inside of the system found, apparently by accident, as it was once said that Alan Greenspan had found by accident, that if you talk about rising wages, people get upset, but if you talk about wage pressure, people get less upset. Well, it started to be found that non-recourse loans had a particular ring to them, and it didn't have the same ring as a bailout or handout. So there came to be a question as to whether the technical elite were really appropriate to bring into a problem-solving process when the objective of that process might be to restore confidence to the markets, whether or not that confidence was warranted. There might be a good reason for that, but I don't think that that's our reason here today. In some sense, we are here in a physics institute, and I think, as Neil says, that picks a side. We have to have a certain kind of loyalty and integrity to the truth, and if you want to do the other thing, that may be valid, but this probably isn't the place to do it. So here are Swagel's own words. Many people in Washington, D.C. did not understand the implications of non-recourse lending from the Fed. The latter lesson was somewhat fortuitous in that it took some time before the political class realized that the Fed had not just lent J.P. Morgan money to buy Bear Stearns, but in fact now owned the downside of a portfolio of $29 billion of possibly dodgy assets. And the claim is that this discovery is driving what is behind the current complicated scheme, which is being proposed for the nation's banks. So the person who got me into this question was Adil Abdulali, who called me up at one point in 2001 and said, you know, we're having this problem pricing illiquid assets. And I knew nothing about the topic, and Adil and I, who've been friends for a long time, had a very efficient argument for about half an hour. And we got off the phone, wrote it up, and turned out Risk Magazine was interested in it. So that was my first introduction that it's very hard to do that in mathematics or physics, and it clearly this was a much younger subject, and therefore very enticing. We came up with, we didn't tell anybody that it was physics inspired, but it's too late now. So the whole idea was that illiquid assets, you would gather quotes for the illiquid asset, and you would take that as a poll from a distribution, and that you would stop asking the question, which we then viewed as classical, what is the price of that asset? And you would say, what is the wave function of that asset? By way of a quantum analogy, what would measurement be? Right? The collapse of the state vector would be price discovery. You actually have a transaction, and after that point, everybody can see what the price is, and it collapses to some classical value, and then the variance starts expanding out. So the point was is that we didn't think it was a quantum system, but we said the quantum analogy is quite powerful. And then the question is, what is the best classical analog of the quantum system? It had to take into account that the increased variance of the function over time should cause a discount, or in the lingo of the trade, a haircut. So I hope I'm a little bit colorblind. I think that's a blue line creeping down the bottom and a yellow line or a green line on the top. That is the penalty for the variance. Now, you'll hear people saying, you know, the problem is that the markets can't function because there's uncertainty and the balance sheets are burdened down, all this visual sort of imagery that things are clogged, so we've got to get people lending again to restore confidence, get rid of the uncertainty. What happens if you get rid of the uncertainty? You push the valuation line that we were claiming should be there, which is that blue line on the bottom, back up, thereby increasing the value of the asset, because in fact, people were being paid to bear the risk of the illiquidity to begin with. Now, the problem is that from these formulas, you can attempt to price what that handout is worth. So it's absolutely the case that if you ask Adil to go to Washington, you're going to have a problem, that his hands are somewhat tied. He's published on the subject, and he has a means of trying to estimate what the value of the giveaway is worth. So the question is, do you want the transparency, which is what you'll get from Adil, or are you actually valuing perversely the translucence or opaqueness? Is there a premium on things that are hard to figure out and a problem for people who help you figure them out? I should point out that for some time, this has been the top link under valuation of illiquid assets. So if you put in the number one question, which is supposedly taking the world down, this is not a terribly difficult scheme to find. And yet, Adil has not been called. Now, when I started hearing that my friends weren't being called, I called up Emmanuel and I said, have you been called? Because Emmanuel had hosted Adil in his seminar when Adil was talking about the shape of fraud. The people I respected most who were trying to look at these problems, in general, were being specifically avoided. I thought that was kind of interesting. So what are we doing here? One, we are trying to start an economic Manhattan Project to have economic input increasingly decided by the quality of economic reasoning, period. Again, I see the reasons that you might not want to do that, but I'm not on that team. Economics as a field, however, currently repels many of the scientists who have attempted to make contact. I'm not making a judgment on economics, but let me tell you, when you talk to physicists and biologists, people talk like they're coming out of a bad relationship if they've had a relationship with economics. Too many people are not talking either to the right economists or getting to the right people or getting their ideas heard. So there's clearly something going wrong because this degree of interoperability with the other fields does not seem to be taking place with economics. So our first goal here is to begin to attract economists, scientists, accountants, mathematicians, and engineers to a revitalized scientific field, which is completely interoperable. When I go into a biology department, I don't expect to have conflicts or ideological difficulties. I expect to be able to ask a few questions, and I get a lesson. That's the same thing if they come and they want to discuss the mathematics of protein folding from us. In general, this interoperability works relatively well, with economics as the strongest exception. And I think it's important to try to figure out what, it may be the fault of the hard sciences, but we have to figure out what that conflict is about. Our second goal is to build a credible alternative pool of talent to the closed world of revolving authorities. We intend this group to start competing its ideas immediately against established theories to test their worth. It is very important to understand the role of the scientific method. We have to test our theories, and as Neil says, it can be a very aggressive process. We hope that everybody shakes hands when it's all said and done, but there's no way of having the ideas get sorted out without a certain degree of conflict. So we need to bring in, hopefully, collegial conflict, conflict that is productive, but conflict that nevertheless forces people to deal with these questions. I want to know that a biologist like Dick Alexander can talk to an economist promoting a vision of homo economicus, and they can have a discussion as to whether or not that is a correct simplification that works for most economic points. If we are invited in and given access and responsibility, I think we should put our talents to use in the public service akin to the aforementioned Manhattan Project. Definitely speaking, We have technical talent. Many of the equations were borrowed from our fields. The analogies were borrowed from our fields. And I think that if you want to think about it, we have a country that's like a very rich family, right? Canada or the US, either one works. Very rich families typically have a layer between them and the market called a family office. And those family offices attempt to use expertise to sort through the mumbo jumbo, to do the due diligence, and to figure out whether things are a good deal from the managers who are hawking their wares. It's very important that we have some kind of a layer that is a check on the current layer that is there today, in my opinion. So think about this as potentially becoming a national or international family office. Now the question is, why is this conference different? So I think this conference has the potential to be really different. Let's see if that works out. One, we're failure focused. Success is not an option. Okay? These systems are too hard. We are going to fail, absolutely guaranteed. Okay? So before we start, I don't want to hear that these systems are too hard. The question is, how much are we going to fail? Right? What can be said in these contexts? If you're going to fail, you know that you have to make a provision for the ability to say nothing. Now, why have we invited Nassim here? Nassim tells me at every opportunity that he is one of the most ignorant people because he understands very little about the markets. And yet, he seems to understand a great deal about the markets than most of the people who tell me that they really understand the markets. So we are focused on this degree of comfort with our ignorance. And I think it's also important to know that in the sciences, we very often say, I have no idea the answer to that problem, which is something much less common in an economics conversation. The basic failure plan has to be in place. Failures to gain predictive power should be handled by increasing reserve and redundancy requirements. As those become onerous, people will say, I can't live with these kind of requirements. We say, great, go off and study, learn something. Build an agent-based model. Try to solve something exactly. If you can show us that you have better understanding of the world, we'll lift the requirement. That's the right way to do things. But you should have a plan for failure at the outset and know that you're going to do so. Next, we are not at risk of reinventing the wheel. Everyone worries that people from outside don't understand how much has been accomplished in economics. It is very hard to find anything that the economists have not dealt with it one way or another in their literature. This is one of the reasons that Barclay Rosser is here. He has an encyclopedic knowledge of all sorts of things that have been tried. So if you think you have a new idea, it's probably the case that somebody has been there at least to some extent before you. So we are absolutely focused on reinventing the wheel. If you get the triangular wheel, and then the square wheel, and then the octagonal wheel, sooner or later you're going to get a wheel that really, really works, right? The key problem is that the periphery of economics is huge, and it's very, very interesting. But it's not interoperable. It's not made of the same Lego as the core of economics, which is where things get built vertically. So one of our goals is to move things from the periphery and not worry so much about whether or not somebody else has been there first. We'll be good about priority if somebody will alert us. We're focused on design. We want to use a very small group of tools. People tend to notice lots of individual curlicues. If you tried to think about a cladogram in nature, all the different ways that nature has found to affect certain strategies, the complexity is mind-boggling. But the things that have created that complexity are your only hope into trying to make sense of it. So somebody like Dick Alexander understands that a very small group of rules creates a tremendous amount of complexity. What we want to do is to find that small group of Lego pieces and rules for connecting them. And we are going to be very harsh on ourselves to try to make sure that we don't just keep adding bells and whistles. Next, we are not burdened by this orthodox heterodoxy ideology division. I'm not even sure what this is or who created it. Why are they not homodox? It doesn't make sense to me. At some level, we have one physics. As much as I've seen the loop quantum gravity guys and the string guys go after each other, the division is far less significant, in my opinion, than the orthodox, heterodox. And I think that this is just something which, when you let people in from outside, it just doesn't make sense. Next, we are motivated by love, fascination, embarrassment, exasperation, and fear of economics. Okay? That's a lot of complex emotions. But I don't see hatred or envy among them. We are not in weaker social sciences wishing we were economists, nor do we think that economists are just weak people. We're pretty impressed with their creativity, brilliance, and they look a whole lot like us. Next, the stance on cynicism. Economics is too sentimental. That's not something you hear very often. In general, economists talk about decisions being made by individual agents who are self-interested. Well, that's pretty much what agents do. They're self-interested. They can achieve altruism. They can achieve all sorts of things. But altruism can be pretty grisly, right? You want to go see a pretty grisly bit of altruism, look up David Attenborough's chimpanzee attack on YouTube, and look at the end where one chimpanzee hands another a piece of cannibalized infant chimpanzee, right? That's altruism in action. We're not necessarily excited about altruism. We're excited about genotype, phenotype, how it is that we build culture, why we build culture. Our concern is that economists get sentimental about the invisible hand. The idea that everything gets corrected for it may be true, but how it gets corrected is incredibly important. If you view World War II as a full employment program that rescued an economy, that's a pretty grisly full employment program. And so it's very important to avoid kinds of self-regulation that we cannot stand as civilized people. Lastly, I don't know if that's right, we are interested in giving a voice to topics that others wish not to entertain. Should we engage in national spite with a respectable budget? Spite technically is defined, if I understand it correctly, as paying a cost to extract a cost. Many of us wish to pay a cost to extract a cost with people we feel have been perversely incentivized to do things that are dangerous in our economy. In general, we are told that spite is a bad emotion, but yet it seems quite commonplace and widely spread. I suspect that there is some basis for this spite that is entirely good, wholesome, and worth getting behind. Let us consider whether we need a national spite budget, whether we need to introduce the word clawback into our vocabulary in order to prevent dangers to future generations. Perhaps this is our concern for our children and grandchildren, so that an example is made and we don't continue to learn the same lesson of looking forward and not back and declaring a time of healing as soon as something bad is found to have happened. Next, why are we different? Because the physicists here will subordinate to the biologists on matters of agency. We're not looking for primacy here. In general, we are here to facilitate biological agents by using our talents in physics. The evolutionary biologists, are they going to turn this all into a big evolutionary game for reproductive fitness at any cost? No. We have evolutionary biologists who are warning us, do you know what your genes are up to? Maybe you need to really think twice, three times, four times about whether or not you want to go through with the program that you've been given and treat yourself as no different from yeast. If you think of yourself as yeast or a banana slug, or you're terribly concerned about how you digest milk and you want to pass that on to as many offspring as possible, that's, you know, that may be your goal. But are you sure that that's really what you want to do with your life? Next, ideas will be competed without focus on authority and credentialism. A homeless person with a good idea is a somebody with a good idea. Doesn't matter where it came from. Let's figure out how to compete the ideas rather than to compete the humans who seem to carry them. Next, we extend a hand to all reasoned critics regardless of initial differences. You want to talk about getting savaged? We were at edge.org, and Nassim let us have it. But Nassim is a very reasonable guy. He said, oh, I didn't really, you know, fully understand what you were up to. I'm in. Emmanuel Derman said, I'm a highly skeptical person. He's on the program. Barclay Rosser took a shot at us at the marginal revolutions. Who cares? He's here. The fact of the matter is that it's all fun and games, because in the end, it's about the ideas. It's not something that's personal. Next, we are not SFI. We are not SFI. We are not SFI. Check the name. This place is totally different. It's much colder here. I've never been there. Okay, this is a great institute. That's a great institute. But man, does it have different goals. Okay, conference rubric. Pardon me?
Could you characterize the difference in goals?
I can later, but I'm short on time. Okay? I mean, effectively, we are not necessarily about complex systems. I think it'll become clear. Ask it at the end and see if it doesn't come out in the wash. Conference rubric. I am suggesting, right? This is a suggestion, but everybody should break the rules if they're good reason to break the rules. Lee and I thought about this, and we kept coming up with three categories: agency, regulation, and measurement. In general, who's doing what? Do we have an accurate model for who our basic actors are? Next, regulation and self-regulation. When can we rely on self-regulation? And when is the cost of that self-regulation too expensive and we need to engage in something external? Lastly, measurement. How was it that we just got swamped by a crisis that got past, I don't know, all of our gauges and very few people said anything? Something is clearly wrong with the way we are taking data in the system. We seem to have confused, as Nassim was just pointing out, growth for substitution from the future. There are all sorts of primary confusions in our measurement indices that seem to indicate that even if we had the right equations, it may not be the case that we are measuring what we think we're measuring, right? This has come up in physics. There used to be an issue with the bare mass of the electron, and you had a question about whether the term in your equation was what you thought it was. We have to learn to see what we are actually measuring and not just assume that we know what we're doing. OK. I am awestruck by two particular toolkits in science. I mean, there's lots of impressive stuff in science, but there are two toolkits which I just find mind-blowing that anybody was able to think up, and the richness, you could spend a lifetime just scratching the surface. One of those is the selection paradigm. Actors are differentiated by an enormous combinatorial complexity. The interactions are via a tremendous variety of ingenious mechanisms, I mean, mind-blowingly so, involving information and nutrient exchanges. Highest level theory in the hard sciences, so it's very far away from quarks. Dominated by combinatorics and simple algebra due to the absence of real valued variables. When a bower bird chooses to impress a potential mate, he gathers sometimes as much blue stuff as he can find because blue is rare. So blue is a proxy for fitness. Okay, well, if we gather money, very often that money can be measured down to decimal places. It helps to have number walking around, but in fact, in natural selection, most of the time we don't have a highly reliable numerical indicator. In geometric dynamics, I would call it physics, but I really want to think of something higher level that gets instantiated to physics so it can be instantiated to something else. But primary example is classical and quantum field theory. Actors are differentiated by a tiny number of parameters. Interactions via a small variety of canonical mechanisms involving real and complex numbers. Absolutely, as Neil was saying, the lowest level theory in the hard sciences, and it's dominated by deep extensions of calculus and linear algebra. We can hit you with lots of fancy names for what it is we do in these subjects, but very often, if you have to, you can break it down to calculus and linear algebra. That is the Lego that makes physics sing. Now, in some sense, this is my favorite and most important slide. I don't know if it's going to wow anybody else. But if there is a natural meeting point of these two theories, which never get a chance to talk to each other, absent some possibilities and work of Lee's, where is that going to happen? Is there any place where we're going to get to do both of these things? If you think that you know people who do one kind of these things, they're very often not thinking about the other. I think if there's any place that this is going to work out, it's going to be in economics. Here's the reasoning. The market actors are humans, right? If you think about them as software classes, they should be subclassed from primates. So the fact is that a consumer should not be built up directly as Homo economicus, but should be subclassed from primate. But what happens is that that market interaction of that individual is going to limit its richness. So markets make us less interesting. I have all of my thoughts, my hopes, and my dreams, but when I go to the supermarket, I'm just a consumer in the line with a bunch of goods, paying for it the same way everybody else is. Interactions are via a tremendous variety of ingenious mechanisms involving information, tool, and nutrient exchanges, but they pass through a bottleneck of number. And that bottleneck says that markets bring selection within reach of the geometric dynamics. And that's the key opportunity. Sewell Wright tried to do something like this in fitness landscapes, but the fact of the matter is that it had to go through an artificial condensation where the choosing the numbers was something that the biologists had to add, and therefore it was destructive of the actual system. Here you have the agents figuring out how they're going to appropriate real numbers to conduct their lives. Highest level theory in the hard sciences, but lowest in the social sciences. Dominated, again, by calculus and linear algebra, that magic pair that makes the Lego. Now, I'd like to make this argument in the crowd. I hope that there are some physicists here. But this is not from a physics presentation. It's from the Center for Economic Performance in the London School of Economics. And what do you see? You see two paths, path A and path B, and somebody complaining about things failing tests due to path dependence. Now, let me just ask a question. Unscripted, what is people worrying about path dependence and drawing that picture strike in the mind of a physicist? Any physicist? Go ahead. Okay. Yep. If I put a solenoid in the middle of that thing, Aronoff-Bohm effect. We dealt with this before. It turned out that it wasn't a flaw in the theory. It wasn't a bug, it was a feature. And it was a feature that blew our minds and made our lives richer and taught us something that was initially extremely difficult to think about. That you could pass current through something in the center of a system and affect the system around it, even though you thought that that system was insulated, and create some kind of an effect that people initially didn't believe could possibly be real, but it was. Okay, the same thing is happening in economics. We need to bring the expertise that lives in this building to buildings all over the world and tell them, you know, we made the same mistake before, and you're making it now, and it's the same system repeating itself. Now, I'm calling this the Aronoff-Rilakis effect. Has anyone ever seen these two people together at the same time? Zvi Rilakis is associated with the Divisia index pictured in the previous economic slide, Yakir Aronoff with Bohm-Aronoff effect. I think that we will find that there are superficial similarities, but in fact, the system is almost exactly the same. So I'm going to claim, look, I'm trying to do this from a position of something that I know something about. So, you know, write about what you know, talk about what you know. I think that we have at least the starting point for a new marginal revolution. Remember, the marginal revolution is the penetration of the differential calculus into economic theory that absolutely revolutionized the subject. Well, every time we had a version of the differential calculus penetrate economics, the stochastic differential calculus penetrated and we got black Scholes, right? Linear programming penetrated, we had a revolution. This is perhaps our best version yet of the differential calculus. Now, we don't say it that way, so we hide it in geometry courses or upper-level physics courses, but the fact of the matter is we should be teaching this simply as advanced calculus. But how do you get economists to learn gauge theory on fiber bundles to understand the error that they're making if they're calling this an error of measurement? Well, you can go to the web, and you can find a picture of a fiber bundle. I don't know if that helps you, but it reminds me of pulling a Band-Aid off really, really hard and ripping a bunch of hair off of your arm. Not the way to entice people. It's very tough to read this stuff. It's like a symphony that's never performed, and somebody hands you the sheet music and says, oh, doesn't it make you cry? Well, it depends who you are. But at this conference, we have a twist. Where's Enthod? All right, see these three guys here? These three modest guys over there are the translators for this conference. If you have an idea, these guys are so quick and their tools are so good that they will mock up a model in no time flat so that Dick Alexander, who speaks biology, and Lee Smolin, who speaks physics, will be able to talk to each other as long as those three guys can understand it. And I started treating them as programmers, and I realized that's a mistake. Because as soon as I started talking to them about gauge theory and economics, I started getting scientific questions back as they were mocking up my 3D pictures. So hit them with your worst, with your most difficult stuff, and you'll find that you're talking to a colleague rather than a programmer. But let me just show you a picture that I don't think anybody else has ever done. I haven't found it on the web. Maybe that's what I should say. This is a picture of the path lifting problem. In the base space here, we have a ratio of the price of chicken to the price of beef compared to the quantity of beef and the quantity of chicken as a ratio. As it goes around, I'm measuring in the vertical direction the total quantity of beef if I was only moving that basket by substitution effects. Now, there you see the failure of that system to close. The fact that that becomes a helix rather than a closed loop. In economics, that would be called the cycling problem, or the path dependence error, or something like that. In mathematics, that would be the holonomy, right? It's not an error. It's a gift. It's taken us a long time to figure that out. And the fact is that I could have taken you through weeks and weeks of equations, or I could take you through 30 seconds with Enthod and they can show you how to do this stuff quickly. So by all means, they're here on their own nickel, and they're going to hand out software, I think, to everybody along with a subscription. And I think they're going to play an important role scientifically in this conference, so I'm pretty excited about it. By the way, I have no commercial relationship with these guys. I just really, really... What? All right. Okay. So how does this link physics to biology, and how potentially rich is this link? Well, price and quantity indices are going to be abelian gauge theory. Trade indices are going to be non-abelian gauge theory. So you're not going to be able to get the solutions with an exponential because you'd need a time ordering operator. This is for the physicists in the room. Human preferences turn out to be an infinite dimensional diff S1 theory. Right? So the space of preference maps is some big infinite dimensional space. And the space of cardinal functions, which generate those as level sets, is some infinite dimensional space. And there's a group action that relate the two. So suddenly, out of nowhere, the tools that economists already use create a natural structure of an infinite dimensional principle bundle based on the main group in string theory, right? Well, what are seasonal preferences? When was the last time you saw someone spill eggnog on their bikini, right? We don't, in general, consume these products at the same time. So all of us have preferences all year long, and my December preferences aren't the same as my June preferences. Now, the fact is that that requires a string. Further, there's a fiction called the representative consumer on which we base things like price indices. Well, how do you construct a representative consumer when Arrow tells us that preferences aren't commensurable? We can't necessarily aggregate preferences. Well, it's a classical problem. There's no one preference map. But what if instead it's some kind of a wave function in a blob and you have to propagate it? Okay, so now you have some kind of a wave function on strings on an infinite dimensional space with a group hanging over it. This is why we're in this building. Representative consumers, good. Consumer markets, turns out that all of this stuff is social choice theory until you put in a market. And the fact is that you don't have connections. Connections give you the ability to do welfare theory, and a market is required to do welfare. So what is there for selection to do? Well, first of all, it's important to realize that even though we only have one of these guys on the program, maybe the most important person, and certainly more important than everything I'm saying here today, is going to be Dick Alexander, who's batting cleanup for all of us. He doesn't do much of this stuff. He doesn't get invited out much. But we believe that markets are the continuation of selection by other means, right? I mean, at some level, we are humans, we are primates, and we are continuing to do what it is that we have always done, but we found a new way of doing. So the core neoclassical model, Homo economicus, is forever emerging from its abiological origin, right? At some level, physics and economics became deeply intertwined, and at some level, we did not fully incorporate the Darwinian... 5 minutes? Okay. So the problem is it begins as a purely semantic creature with total fidelity to proximate preferences. We don't usually use multiple preference maps. It's been tried by people like Timur Kuran, but in general, it's not something that we do frequently. We've got to correct for this, because the current corrections are done piecemeal. It's not that they don't know that these models are wrong, but they're put in as anomalies. So what we are doing here today is to take on the challenge of trying to build a new model, Homo selectus, which recovers Homo economicus as a degenerate special case. Now, I want to talk about how deeply far-reaching the move is from where we are to a selection-based model. It is very common to hear people enthusiastic about a little bit of evolution in their models. But evolution isn't a spice, right? It's a deep, deep commitment. Evolution, the way it's done today by our best people, is not based upon the fact that it can do a little bit here and a little bit there, but it's a challenge that maybe everything comes from selection and that everything has to have an expression at that level. In that world, it is almost impossible for a biologist to work with a model which is a perturbation on perfect information with rational expectations. You want to turn off the biologists, tell them that you expect that perfect information is a place to perturb around. Now, what do you see here on the left? You see an insect, a female wasp, sitting on a flower. Now you see a male wasp coming to mate. Except that flower, right, that petal was mimicking a female wasp. It was a wax museum replica of a female wasp. So this orchid, the mirror orchid, grows this flower along with some pheromones, this petal along with some pheromones, to deceive specifically this particular pollinator through a strategy known as pseudocopulation. And it's good enough to fool me, right? Now, the fact is that you... Thank God. Oi. This can only happen over generations and generations and generations. It is not the case that lying actors are quickly removed from the market and replaced by truthful ones. As Dick Alexander said, it is the case that maybe all truth that we generate is initially constructed only as camouflage for the few lies that we really, really want to tell. Right? That's a very seditious idea. But the fact of the matter is that if you want to talk to somebody like Dick Alexander, you got to start from a different perspective, and you can't tell him how things are going to be from the beginning. We have to check with these guys when we have conflict between our disciplines. I'm not saying Dick's right. Maybe Dick's wrong. Let's go fight him. Let's have a disagreement. Let's figure out who's right and who's wrong, because we're in the same territory. These fields have overlap, and they don't agree. Let's figure out what's right and what's true. Next, theory of the family. I keep hearing about the free market. People are enthusiastic about the free market. There are very few things in life that cannot be improved with the introduction of a market. But there are very few things that can't be ruined by freeing that market. What happens in a free market? There is only one, right? And it's the market for nutrients and protein and reproductive opportunities. So I thought you'd like to see some pictures of some boobies. This is the Nazca booby. The Nazca booby is seen here with its chicks. What are those chicks doing? They're engaged in the family activity known as obligate siblicide, or facultative brood reduction. I'm not sure which. So a close-up. Mama is watching one chick violently push the weaker second chick out of the nest and will watch it die when she could easily intercede to save it. It is not that we find Gary Becker and his theory of the family too mercenary or too unsentimental. The fact is that we understand just how far nature will go in order to be ruthlessly efficient. And in the original free market, there is undeniably a beauty and a majesty to the simplicity of the rules that govern. However, the barbarity of the market is unquestionable as well. And inviting a free market in to regulate human behavior is something that I think almost no one in society has the stomach to do. So we should be very honest with what we mean by free markets. Here's the mom, happy, tending her chick with the other one left to die. Let me lastly say that one of the things that I want to do is I want to get rid of things that cannot possibly be understood outside of neoclassical economics. There are certain places where the field goes for broke and decides that it's going to take a risk in order to make sure that it is dominant over all other sciences. And it is time for us in the harder sciences to step in and say, really? Let's compete the ideas. When I found out that economics was largely founded on the supposition that agents are homogeneous and that their preferences are in general unchanging, I could not believe my eyes. It did not make sense. And then I went around and people would tell me, oh, you don't have a solution to the changing preference problem because Gary proved that preferences don't change. Gary did nothing of the kind. It's time to have the argument. And it's time to have the argument with the Bob Trippers and Dick Alexanders of the world, and I'll do it if they won't. We cannot have these fields with different rules. We have to become interoperable. Let me just close because, okay. First of all, I want to say this is not a highly secretive program. We are not here to blow up the world. Perhaps it was a poor choice of words, Economic Manhattan Project. However, it is undeniably an important part of the physics culture. And aside from the product that it produced a bonding and a knowledge and a community, which is what I was seeking to get at. So I'm going to stick with the analogy, but our heart's in the right place. Just send email to economicmanhattanproject@gmail.com. If you want to join, tell us about what it is that you do well, and how you might like to help. And we understand that everybody's busy, and we'll figure out what to do with these emails later and see if we gain some momentum and some steam. I thank you for your time.
Uriel Rubini, who's sometimes known as Dr. Gloom, because he did indeed play the person saying things are not going right. He kept saying it, and some people believe because he said it so many times, he in fact caused this problem. I'm proud he's a graduate of the Harvard Economics.